Good afternoon. This is Nicole Gelinas, a contributing editor to City Journal and senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. I'm talking this afternoon with Roger Lowenstein. He's the author of the new book, The End of Wall Street, and he's also a contributing writer to the New York Times magazine. Roger, thanks for talking with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
So, in your book, you write that a bell tolled for Wall Street in the fall of 2008 as capitalism and the government figured out that capitalism needs capital, and we had the government put hundreds of billions of dollars worth of emergency taxpayer money into these failing financial firms. Let me ask you a big question up front. Did markets fail or did the government fail?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first failure was really of markets. Yes, Fannie and Freddie were obviously huge failures, and you have to lay that mostly at the feet of the government. But Fannie and Freddie, for instance, were merely trying to catch up with private label competitors such as Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, we've all heard of them, who were hand and foot rushing to get into the mortgage business. No one, for instance, told Angelo Mozzillo at Countrywide to start issuing subprime mortgages. These new mortgage operations weren't even banks. They weren't subject to the banking regulations and strictures, the Community Reinvestment Act. Markets go through bubbles. The U.S. government wasn't around when the price of tulips went up in Holland. Markets can make mistakes, and there were two levels of mistake. There was a tremendous bubble in the mortgage market, and that was really compounded by leverage secondarily in the Wall Street market, which was buying these mortgages and securitizing them. Obviously, the government did its share to make things even worse.
And you note quite correctly that no one told Angelo Mozzillo at Countrywide to do these risky mortgages. No one told Golden West the same thing. No one told AIG and Citi.
How about Merrill Lynch?
Right,
$50 billion on the balance sheet.
Merrill Lynch is another one.
Yeah.
Why, these companies could not have done this if they had not been able to go out and borrow tens and hundreds of billions of dollars, really, at very cheap interest rates from global bondholders. Why did lenders give them so much money with which to blow up the economy? And people talk about the shareholders. Why didn't the bondholders actually seem to care what was going on and what these banks were doing with this money?
Well, if you mean the bondholders of Merrill Lynch, that's a great question. I think they're lazy. I think there's a tremendous tendency of people to say, it's a big firm, nothing can happen. I will say that after Bear Stearns was bailed out, there was a feeling that on the credit side, as distinct from the equity side, the bondholder side you're asking about, we don't have to worry about lending to Wall Street because the Fed has our back. And I quote an economist, Bob Barbera, who told his clients that. And it was a logical thing to conclude. The government guaranteed the debt of Bear Stearns effectively, so why not Lehman? However, even had they not, by then so much of the money was borrowed that you still have to ask, even before that, 2006, 2007, as they were piling up all this debt, much of it short-term debt, backed by very dicey assets, completely violating the most time-tested rule, which was they were funding illiquid long-term assets with overnight funding. Where were the bondholders? And I think they were just lazy. And, they thought it hadn't happened before, so, it wouldn't happen now.
Do you think they expected bailouts even before 2007? You wrote about the long-term capital management bailout in another wonderful book, When Genius Failed. Do you think the bondholders learned the wrong lesson from that 10 years earlier?
To a degree. Bailout's probably the wrong word for LTCM because there was no public money, but, of course, the Federal Reserve sponsored the private rescue of that hedge fund. I think maybe in a sort of a general level, there was not enough pain from that episode because the Fed rushed in so energetically. Actually, the dot-com bubble took off right then and there. I think the Fed's continued efforts after the 2001 recession to keep rates low, to keep that cycle going where Americans would overspend their means, borrow from overseas, the money would come back from China in the form of securities, keeping our rates low, keeping our mortgage machine going. I think the Fed was way too cavalier in keeping that going. And Bernanke, interestingly enough, he was just then a governor, not the Fed chairman, was very aware of that cycle and wrote a celebrated paper on it. And he said in the paper, we know that this is keeping the prices, pushing the prices of real estate in the United States higher than it would ordinarily go. So he was aware that the prices of homes at a granular level in Phoenix and in Coral Gables and Southern California, where else, were not just a bank, supply and demand in those areas. They were following the flight of money from Shanghai and wherever, and you know, that should have been a troubling sign, I think.
Right, and you talk about the controller of the currency, one of the major regulators of the banking system and the financial system, being horrified in 2005 when he started to learn about these mortgages. He wanted the government to implement a stronger standard for basically doing what is common sense, ensuring that someone borrowing money for a mortgage is able to pay that back.
Yeah, how about that? That's a good idea, isn't it? And the standard that had been adopted instead of that was, can they pay it back, or at least can they refinance it, which is a polite way of saying the bigger fool theory. It means if they can't pay back my loan, they can borrow from someone else and then pay it back and find a bigger fool to lend the money. And that was really the standard being followed. And so the comptroller of the currency tried to get this is a real example of the problem of regulatory overlap, because besides the comptroller, there was the Federal Reserve, the OTC, the OTS, the FDIC, and he really had to get four or five regulatory agencies together in a room agreeing that we had to shut down, or at least slow down, all these new types of mortgages that were so much more lax, mortgages to people who didn't document their income, mortgages to people that got 100% of the balance instead of something like 70 to 80% as traditional. And the fear then, and Alan Greenspan was really the one who slowed the works the most. By the time they did get regulations in against these new types of mortgages, it was too late. The market was already collapsing. And Greenspan's fear, and it comes up today, by the way, was that, look, if we slow down the credit, we're going to precipitate a crisis. And this is always the fear, by the way, that we can't stop the party now, because if we do, people won't get fresh credit, they won't be able to refinance, and the fun will stop. And we're seeing this now in the debates about regulatory reform, both here and in Basel. When they debate new capital rules, the regulators are now afraid that if they say, hey, the banks have to be better capitalized, they won't be able to issue as many loans. And so the recovery will be slower. So we face now a sort of similar choice. Do we want, you know, what I would say is a sounder recovery based on better capital standards, albeit a slower one, or do we want to unleash the banks again to party on?
Right. And on the topic of financial regulation and this bill that will become law next week, the other cornerstone to this bill is this idea of a systemic risk regulator, someone or a council of regulators that can go out and predict and prevent where the next financial crisis is coming from. And in the book, you talk about how even as these companies were collapsing in September 2008, that Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, he thought that the market could withstand Lehman collapse, that even as they figured that out and started to try to take steps to mitigate the collapse, they still weren't really taking AIG seriously. I mean,
AIG. Ben Bernanke was predicting a continuation of a recovery in September of 08. I mean, in fact, the recovery had long since ended. We were in a recession. But the reason I'm skeptical of to anticipate your question, I hope correctly, about the systemic regulator in the bill is, you know, I think these things are just, it's very tough to be the wise man and say, and to look at, you know, such a multifaceted, complex economy and say, is this just a particular risk, you know, or is it going to become generalized? Are we only talking about the Manhattan Institute, or is all of New York City? And you just don't know what's going to... So to expect that any regulator can be that wise, and to me it seems sort of a duplicative responsibility to that of the Federal Reserve, and to enfranchise it with a new name, and I guess it'll include the Fed and you know, other agency people. I'm skeptical. I would rather just see more controls on capital so that when banks fail, because we know they're going to make mistakes, banks always have, they're human, bankers are human, to the extent that they're not so leveraged, the pile up on the highway, the financial highway, I think won't be so great.
Right, and you know, speaking of wise men or the lack thereof, my final question, and something that I think the listeners will find very interesting, is you talk in the book about people who did get it right. You talk about Bob Rodriguez, for one, and you also talk about the difference in outlook between J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon in late 2006, early 2007, versus what Charles Prince and Bob Rubin were saying at Citigroup. So if you could talk about those two things for a couple of minutes, I think it's interesting that some people did get it quite right and have been rewarded in the marketplace despite all of these.
You know, they did, and they did it by sort of old-fashioned investing or security analysis or looking at in a granular level the fundamentals. Bob Rodriguez was a mutual fund investor, runs a firm, FPA, out in California. He couldn't understand why these mortgages were being issued, what the basis of them was, and he went actually to a meeting where one of the rating agencies was talking to investors. Of course, it was these agencies that put these AAA ratings on them that gave bondholders around the world the peace of mind to buy them, and he said, what are your assumptions? And they said, well, our assumptions are that real estate's going to keep going up. And then he said, well, you know, what if real estate prices stay flat? And they said, well, then the ratings begin to break down. And he said, well, what if real estate actually falls 2%, 2% being more than anybody could conceive of in 2007? And they said, well, if real estate prices were to fall by that much, then the rating model completely breaks down. And, you know, Rodriguez then realized that the entire world was gambling on something that had never happened before, which was a market that would rise forever, and it was already incredibly overheated. He just sold, and it's just common sense. And then to go to the bankers, you know, in Jamie Dimon, you have a CEO who looks just down the pipe at every business. He doesn't get summaries. He wants to know what every business is doing. And he saw that in the mortgage market in 2006, there were surprising delinquencies, rising foreclosures, and so on. The people in these subprimes were beginning to default at levels they had never seen before, and it wasn't yet at a level that threatened the bank or threatened the system, but he could see where it was going, and he just said, you know, we want out of here, as distinct from, say, Stan O'Neill at Merrill Lynch, who, even as default numbers were rising, was pushing his troops to buy more and more and more of these mortgage securities because the prices of the securities themselves were still high, even though the underlying asset, the mortgage, was collapsing. So I think that's really the heart of the difference. One of them was looking at, is everybody buying these securities? And the other was looking at, what's under these securities? What's holding them up? What is the value of the actual asset, the mortgage? That's really the difference between someone who's really investing and evaluating and doing the noble work of capitalism, of pricing assets efficiently, and someone who's just following the crowd.
Right, and that's an excellent way of putting it, the noble work of capitalism. And it's a wonderful detailed illustration in the book of how, despite this enormous bubble, these enormous problems between government signals in going to these huge financial institutions, there were still people out there who did do the right analysis, make the right decisions, and it's regulators' job to create the environment where companies can succeed and fail and not take down the rest of the economy. And to that end, you know, I'd like to conclude with a quote from your book, which I think sums up the problem. You write that Wall Street institutions emerged from this crisis more protected than ever. Whether this was entirely to their advantage was debatable. Denial of the right to fail inexorably limits the right to succeed. And that's the end of the quote. And I would just note that J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon has been rewarded in the marketplace, but yet they still must compete with these institutions that really should have failed. And again, thank you, Roger, for joining us. And Roger's book, it's Roger Lowenstein. The book is called The End of Wall Street, and you can read about Roger's book in my new City Journal essay at city-journal.org. Thanks, Roger.
Nicole, it was my pleasure.